I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. The Attorney General's suit against Donald Trump may be the most dangerous yet. The headline of a story by Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. The Attorneys General of the District of Columbia and Maryland gives a long list of holdings they claim to run afoul of the Emoluments Clause, and they feature the Domestic Emoluments Clause as well. After that story appeared earlier this week, congressional Democrats filed an emoluments suit against the president, alleging by retaining interests in a global business empire, he has violated constitutional restrictions on taking gifts and benefits from foreign leaders. On Monday, we decided to do a show on this issue. Then there was yesterday, a gunman opening fire on a congressional baseball practice. And we thought that we needed to pay attention to that, which we will. And then last night, we learned that Special Counsel Robert Mueller has requested interviews with the Director of National Intelligence, the head of the National Security Agency, and the former NSA Deputy Director, giving an indication that he will investigate whether President Trump obstructed justice. So we'll cover all of that this hour with special emphasis on the emoluments suit, because our guest knows that suit like nobody else. Professor Richard Painter is our guest. He's a professor of corporate law at the University of Minnesota. He's also the vice chair of CRU, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. He served as the chief White House ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush from 2005 to 2007. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Painter, a pleasure to have you with us. We have a lot to cover. Hello.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. I want to start with what Gabby Giffords wrote. It's in the Washington Post today. She woke up yesterday morning to images that she prayed she would never see again. A member of Congress, a congressional aide shot, children and bystanders scrambling for cover, fear, danger, rage, etc. She goes on to say, we know, as always, that no one law could prevent a shooting like this, but we also know that we must acknowledge a problem and an unacceptable rate of gun violence in this country. Do we need to address that issue once again, and will we?
Well, we clearly do. We need to protect the right of law-abiding Americans to have a gun for recreation and occasionally for self-defense. But it's absolutely critical to make sure that guns do not fall into the hands of terrorists, people with criminal records, or people who are mentally ill. And there's got to be a way to assure the right to bear arms for those who are entitled to have a gun, and to make sure that those people who are dangerous do not have access to weapons. Mm-hmm. And we need to think seriously about background checks and other measures to make absolutely sure the guns are not falling into the wrong hands, because we have a lot of this going on in the United States. We have just in Chicago alone, hundreds and hundreds of deaths every year. Children are murdered because the wrong people have guns. So this isn't about the right to bear arms for the types of people who ought to be carrying a gun. It's making sure the guns don't fall into the wrong hands. And that's something we ought to be together on. We ought to be unified, Republicans, Democrats, gun owners, those who don't own guns. Because nobody wants some nut job going and taking a shot at members of Congress or at our children in the playground.
Right. Yeah, it was a horrendous story. Is there a political element to this story, Professor Painter, or not?
Well, we've obviously had trouble with implementing reasonable regulation of firearms in the United States. We've got the National Rifle Association, is a very powerful lobby, a lot of money from the gun manufacturers, and then a number of people appear to have an ideological commitment to the notion that just about anybody ought to get a firearm. I don't understand it. Say, once again, law-abiding citizens ought to have firearms. But, some guy's running around with a Bin Laden T-shirt or something, or somebody who is psychologically unbalanced, has a criminal record. Those are not the kind of people who ought to be having guns. And we ought to be able to accommodate firearm ownership with some reasonable regulation to try and keep the guns out of the wrong hands.
Yeah, it appears obvious that the guy who did the shooting yesterday shouldn't have had a gun from his background.
Well, that's quite obvious. I understand he had some trouble down there in Illinois a number of years ago where he was threatening somebody with a firearm and discharged it. I don't know if that's true or what happened. But one of the things we can do is make absolutely sure that those cases are prosecuted and result in, if there's a plea bargain, in an arrangement where the person does not own firearms in the future. Because somebody who threatens someone with a gun and discharges it, that's exactly the kind of person who should not be owning a firearm because they could be the next person who goes after a member of Congress.
Another,
or say one of our kids in the park.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that has an expectation for tonight's baseball game is that it's the beginning of maybe a bipartisan effort, Democrats, Republicans getting together on the holy baseball ground to play a game, which has been going on for 100 years in this country. Will it be significant? Will tonight's event be significant?
Well, I do hope that Democrats and Republicans can get along better and reduce the partisan rancor. We need to have two good, strong political parties in this country. I'm a Republican. I support the Republican Party. I have some kind of differences with the way some things are being managed right now, but I think we need to have a stronger Republican Party, a stronger Democratic Party, and that's what's going to make America strong, if the both political parties are strong and not demonizing each other, but having a healthy competition just like you would out there on the baseball field.
Mm-hmm. Other news yesterday, we learned that Special Counsel Robert Mueller has requested interviews with the Director of National Intelligence, the head of National Security Agency, former NSA Deputy Director. Is this an indication that he is going to be investigating Donald Trump for possible obstruction of justice?
Well, I think that's quite clear, but I think that was inevitable. Anyway, the president just about admitted in press interviews and to the Russian ambassador that he fired James Comey because of the Russia investigation. That in and of itself might very well be obstruction of justice. And then we could have the special prosecutor uncovering other communications by the president to try to stop that investigation. It really is unfortunate. The president should have let that Russia investigation alone. Chances aren't high that he would have ended up getting in trouble, that he collaborated with the Russians. I doubt it. But he wasn't willing to let it alone. I think he's trying to protect some people working for him. I don't know what's going on, but he has made matters considerably worse by firing Director Comey because of the Russia investigation, then going on out there and saying that. And that's the Russian ambassador, and things just seem to be getting worse. They're floating rumors at the White House. Somebody's floating a rumor the president would want to fire Special Counsel Mueller. That would be a terrible mistake. So I will just have to see where this goes. It's a very unfortunate situation.
All right, let's move into emoluments, and you know this issue. I've heard you talk on TV about the emoluments issue. There are a couple lawsuits, and I know you were involved in one in January as well. We've got the attorneys general from Maryland and D.C., and then yesterday we have almost 200 Democrats filing suit against the president. Tell us about the emoluments clause. What is it? What are the foreign elements of it? What are the domestic elements of it?
This is a provision of the Constitution that prohibits, or one of the emoluments clauses in the Constitution, prohibits any person who holds a position of trust with the United States government from receiving a present or an emolument from a foreign government. That includes an entity controlled by a foreign government, such as foreign government-owned bank or a sovereign wealth fund. So a lot of the debate turns around what is the meaning of the word emolument. Johnson's English Dictionary of 1755, which was the premier English dictionary around the time of the founding and the drafting of the United States Constitution, defines it as a profit or benefit. That is the meaning of the Latin term, emolumentum, profit or benefit. I think that is the understanding that makes sense, that the founders did not want United States government officials profiting from business dealings, any type of payment from a foreign government, or an entity controlled by a foreign government. There's a lot of that going on in continental Europe at the time. of our Constitution being drafted. The French king was trying to pass out various financial benefits to the Parliament in the United Kingdom. The English king was doing the same thing. And of course, Russia was trying to appease all sorts of various governing authorities and countries near Russia. So the point was that the founders of our country did not want the European powers, at that time superpowers, much wealthier than the United States, basically buying off our government. It was the point of putting a revolution against the English. And then you have a situation where England or one of the other great powers in Europe decides to buy back the United States government simply by putting U.S. government officials in the payroll or doing business deals with them. Mm-hmm. So that's the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. We haven't had a problem with a president here or any other government official under the Emoluments Clause, because most government officials are not in the business of wheeling and dealing with foreign government. There's an exception here with President Trump, and so unfortunately, we do feel that he has been in violation of the Emoluments Clause since he became president. We urge him to sell off the Trump business empire, convert to cash, which would have avoided this problem. He didn't want to do that, and this is not just about hotel rooms for foreign diplomats. I mean, that's obviously part of it, but. There's a lot of financing that goes into a big real estate empire like that, and loans from the Bank of China and other entities. So what we've done is Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington is asked the federal judge in New York to look at the facts and find out what money's coming into the Trump business empire from foreign governments and foreign entities controlled by foreign governments, and then look at the Emoluments Clause and interpret it and tell the president what he can have and what he can't have. That's our suit. There are separate suits. We now see one brought by the District of Columbia in the state of Maryland asking for essentially the same thing. And also a whole bunch of members of the United States House and Senate, apparently mm-hmm. all Democrats. I find this somewhat disturbing and not surprising, because as a Republican, I would think that making sure that our government officials, including Republican presidents, adhere to the United States Constitution and to the intent of the founders is our number one priority. It should be a bipartisan issue, and I hope it can be resolved.
Let me hold you there. We're going to get you on a better phone line. The phone is coming in and out, and we want to hear all of your words, so we will do that and return, and we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. Professor Richard Painter is our guest this hour. He's a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's an expert on emoluments. He was chief White House ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush from 2005 to 2007, and he serves as vice chair of CRU, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. We'll be back with him and with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Professor Painter, I'm wondering about the specific holdings that President Trump has that are worrisome to you, that are in direct conflict with the Emoluments Clause.
Which types of payments he's receiving?
Yeah, foreign or domestic. What worries you?
Well, I think the most worrisome situation involves the money that is being loaned to the Trump business empire. We know that the New York banks cut him off from financing in the early 90s. They weren't getting paid back. There were a bunch of defaults and bankruptcies. So he went off to borrow money in various places all over the world. We don't know about a lot of those. We know something about loans from the Bank of China. You can find out some of it from the land records that the banks take mortgages on the buildings. But it's critically important to know who the President of the United States is financially dependent upon in his business dealings. And if they're foreign governments or foreign government-controlled banks, such as the Bank of China or this Russian bank that Jared Kushner went to have a talk with, that may very well be controlled by Putin's people, That's something that we have a right to know, and it would be unconstitutional if indeed it turns out the bank is controlled by the foreign government and it's extending credit to the Trump business empire. And for that matter, the Kushner business empire, too, because he also is subject to the mind of law.
Mm-hmm. What about the people who are getting space in Trump Tower, people from Qatar and Saudi Arabia and various places? Is that of concern?
Well, it definitely is a concern. Now, those are private citizens paying with their own money. It's not government money. It is not a violation of the Monuments Clause of the Constitution. But the problem is that we've had a number of people buy $15 million condos who they say their job description is consultant from China, for example. Well, the question is where the money is coming from. And all I could say was when a United States company does business outside the United States, and I do a lot of securities corporate work. If you see consultant on the financial statements there, that a couple million dollars has gone to some consultant down in Brazil, that's a red flag for a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. You really wonder whether that company is passing some money to a government official. So a lot of these people call themselves consultants. And what it really is a way to pass money back and forth between a governmental entity and a private party. So once again, we need to figure out when he sells a $15 million condo in New York to a woman from China whose job title is consultant, we'd like to know where she got the $15 million.
Mm-hmm.
But it is only unconstitutional if the $15 million came from the Chinese government.
And what about these? There have been another list of things that are of concern. I'm wondering if you think these are petty or if they're important. The renting golf carts to the Secret Service, the lease on the old post office building, which prohibits a federal employee from benefiting, the promotion of Mar-a-Lago with U.S. government websites, renting space to a government agency for a hotel event, when he decamps to one of his properties and the feds rent rooms for his entourage. Do you see all of those as domestic emolument clause violations?
No, I think a lot of that is very problematic for other reasons. But the emoluments clause focuses on a particular problem. One of the emoluments clauses focuses on payments from foreign governments. The other one applies only to the president, applies to payments from the state. Or payment from the United States government. The president is also not allowed a payment from the United States government in excess of his compensation. So there's some concerns there with respect to those provisions of the Constitution for some of those things. But a lot of the stuff you mentioned is stuff that really may very well violate other ethics laws in the United States or create the appearance of impropriety or create other, you know, serious risks for this administration. It isn't necessarily all of it covered under the emoluments clause or any of the three emoluments, the separate provisions that deal with these issues in the Constitution.
Tell me more about the specifics of the suit that was filed by the attorneys general from Maryland and D.C. It has something to do with sort of an unfair benefit that he would get that the states may lose out on?
Well, I think the attorneys general are concerned about the fact that a lot of businesses have to compete with that Trump Hotel and his businesses. So I think that's one concern the states have, Maryland and the District of Columbia. Another point, though, is the states really have a role in, I think, in enforcing the Constitution, because what is the Constitution? I mean, it's a contractual arrangement among the states to join a union, and states give up a lot of power to the federal government. And if the deal is that the Congress or the president, they aren't upholding their end of the bargain and doing what they ought to be doing under the Constitution, I would think the states would have a pretty good argument for going into court and saying you got to fix it. So the number of different reasons that states are particularly compelling as plaintiffs in a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there will be other states filing lawsuits?
There may be. I don't know what other states are going to want to do.
What should President Trump, to escape all of these lawsuits, what should he have done with all of his holdings?
Well, I think he should have appointed a trustee to dispose of the holdings, to sell off his business interests, particularly those that involve dealings with foreign governments. But really, I think a lot of it could very well have been sold. He's the author of the book, The Art of the Deal, so he could have sold off quite a bit of himself, but once he became president, he could have appointed a trustee to sell off the rest, and then invest in conflict-free assets. That's what every other president has done, and I think that that would have avoided a lot of these problems.
I want to go back to the Democrats' lawsuit. There have been articles that from some legal scholars who are saying because the lawsuit was filed only by Democrats, this could be problematic, that it would have to have been, correct me if I'm wrong, more of a congressional lawsuit, the body as a whole?
Well, I think the I don't think that argument holds water, but I don't think it's relevant whether it's filed by Democrats or Republicans for legal purposes. I think it certainly would help in terms of appearances if Republicans would join me in holding the president accountable and making him do a good job, which includes complying with the Constitution. I think that's in the interest of the Republican Party. But right now, the Republicans don't seem to want to put the heat on the president on this issue. So we have both. They have Democrats in this lawsuit. The problem isn't that they're Democrats. The legal problem issue that's going to be addressed is whether, for Congress to bring an action in court, you need a majority of both houses, or a majority of one of them. I mean, is a court going to be refused to entertain such a suit unless there is a certain critical mass of members of Congress? And so, how big does that critical mass have to be? Now here we got an awful lot of them are suing, but they don't constitute a majority of either house. Is that what the court's going to insist on? I don't think the court should insist on a majority. I think, once again, it's really going to be better for the courts to take this, and you have judges with lifetime tenure who are not Republican or Democrat, make a decision, run it up to the Supreme Court, and let them tell the president what he can do, what he can't do. I think it's going to be a lot better than kicking the can down the road, and then a bunch of liberals get control of Congress, and all they're going to want to do is impeach him over it. So it's not in his interest to try and kick this thing out of the United States court.
When you say Republicans don't want to put the heat on, why don't they? Because they just are worried about what may happen as a result of this and won't be able to advance their agenda?
Well, they don't want to attack a president of their own party. We've got a president who a lot of Republicans did not support in the primaries, and an awful lot of them didn't even really support him in the general election. So they're really stuck in a very challenging situation. President Trump continues to have strong support with a minority of the American people, but that minority is still a fairly significant group within the Republican voter base. And there's always a threat that if somebody stands up to President Trump, that they're going to get hit with a primary challenge, probably by some real right-winger or something. And you know, a lot of members of Congress don't want to have to deal with that, so they're just running for cover. But I don't think that's a responsible thing to do. I think that in the long term, we're going to be much better off if President Trump is held accountable, and the Republicans make it clear he's got to do the right thing. And if he doesn't want to do the job the right way, well, there's always Mike Pence. And well, for a lot of Republicans, he wouldn't be that bad. So I don't think letting President Trump do whatever he wants whenever he wants to do it is a very responsible attitude for elected officials.
And tell me what the process is now. These suits have to be filed. Does some judge, a federal judge, have to say whether or not they have merit before they can proceed?
Well, yes. The judge would decide first whether the plaintiff has standing to bring the lawsuit, and then second, whether the if the plaintiff has standing, what the claims and contentions are, whether they have merit, and to the extent the claim has merit, decide what the remedy ought to be.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number, joining our conversation, we'd like to hear from you about this, 800-486-8655. Professor Richard Painter is our guest. He is a professor of corporate law at the University of Minnesota. He's an expert on the Emoluments Clause and is the vice chair of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. He served as the chief White House ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush from 2005 to 2007. He is a Republican who has, as you can tell, some concerns with this particular administration. Let's go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good afternoon. Let's just say that a court will hear one of these cases. Is it possible that Donald Trump would have to give up his tax returns in discovery?
Well, I think the president would have to give up information that's similar to what's on the tax returns. Whether he gives up the tax returns or whether the Trump Organization directly provides the information to the court that is in the tax returns, that's for the judge to determine. A lot of the information about the Trump Organization would be in his tax returns because he uses so-called flow-through taxation, where all of the activity at the corporate level is taxed to him personally or generates a tax deduction for him personally, and he generates some pretty sizable deductions, apparently, for this. But all of that information would be discoverable, whether it's in the tax returns or whether we get it from another source. It remained to be seen whether the judge would allow that to be released to the public or would only allow private discovery of that by the lawyers and where it would be examined by the court.
Well, I think if he allowed it to become public, I think that's when Donald Trump resigns.
Well, that may be the case. Because, I don't know. It depends on what's in there. If we got a lot of loans from the Russians in there, we got a bit of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly why we're bringing this this lawsuit. We need to find out what's going on. We cannot have a president who is dependent upon a foreign government for financing. Now, if it's private sources in Russia, well, then it's not unconstitutional, but still may make people a little nervous.
Do you know if Jared Kushner has spoken to, in closed session, to the Senate Intelligence Committee or to the FBI or to Mueller's investigation about his conversation with the banker who may have ties to Putin?
No, I do not. I think he will be, but the House and Senate Intelligence Committees are very interested in that topic, and so is Bob Mueller.
Thank you, Bill, very much for your call. We go to Lee in Milwaukee next. Hi, Lee.
Good afternoon. I'm a retired lawyer with a history background, and I am aware that both Washington and Jefferson had direct sales of their items to foreign governments. I'm sure your research would indicate that. We also had the Kennedy Foundations, when Kennedy was president, had considerable foreign holdings. And I even remember Nelson Rockefeller and his confirmation when his whole family had disclosed their holdings, yet they were not required to divest themselves of it. And I'm wondering why Mr. Trump would be in a different position.
Well, the Washington, first of all, we had a provision of the Constitution, and we can go over 200 and some years of history here, close to 50 years. We can try and find violations here and there. Maybe we have, maybe we don't. We go through each one of these historical examples and see if it actually violates the Emoluments Clause. But the fact that you found situations where it was violated and nothing happened doesn't mean that it wasn't violated. Indeed, one key provision of the Emoluments Clause is you shall not do this without the consent of Congress. And that's something we should always keep in mind, that Donald Trump could go to Congress right now, Republican-controlled Congress, work a deal on this, and Congress would consent, and he'd get rid of whatever Congress doesn't consent to. Congress consents to everything, and then our suit would be dismissed the next day. But he won't do that because he won't tell Congress what he's got. But let's go back to all these examples. Washington, Jefferson, what we've seen so far is not demonstrable proof of significant business dealings with a foreign government. But that is still being researched as to what that is. The Justice Department is, of course, taking the other side of that and trying to point out some examples there. A family foundation is different. A spouse is different. I want to emphasize that. We have plenty of people in the Bush administration whose spouses were lawyers for foreign governments. That is not prohibited. The spouse could give speeches for foreign governments, could be a lawyer for foreign governments. That is not prohibited under the Emoluments Clause as has been interpreted by the Department of Justice. Same with family foundations. A family charitable foundation is a separate entity. But if it's a for-profit corporation owned by the office holder, that is covered.
Mm-hmm.
So we can go through these different examples, but over 250 years of history almost We found very, very little has been demonstrated that would be actually a violation of the Emoluments Clause. And remember, dealings with foreigners, that is not a violation. It's got to be a foreign government or an entity controlled by a foreign government.
And Professor Painter, what was the recent ruling by the Department of Justice saying the president could accept foreign payments? What was that all about?
Foreign payments? Well, the Department of Justice has filed a brief. They are representing the president
right.
in the case. So that's not as much a ruling as a position taken by the lawyers for the Department of Justice. He was sued in this case in his official capacity by Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. So the Department of Justice should be defending him. It is at taxpayer expense, but they should be defending him. That's their job. It'd be better if they just advise him to sell off the assets that create the conflicts, but he won't do that, and so they do need to defend his position. And so that's the argument they've made, is that he can take the payments through business transactions with foreign governments so long as they are not at anything other than market value, and that that's not prohibited under the Emoluments Clause.
I see.
We take a very different position on that, but I want to emphasize that even if the Department of Justice were right in their interpretation of the Emoluments Clause, saying the transaction, if it's a fair market value, is okay, still we ought to get discovery. We ought to look and find out what the transactions are, because if he's being loaned hundreds of millions of dollars by foreign government-owned banks, we have the right to find out whether it's in market terms or whether he's getting a special deal. So in any event, I think this case ought to proceed to discovery so we find out what the facts are.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen any indication at all that he may be indebted to Russian banks?
I don't know. There's obviously a lot written out there about his ties to the Russians, business ties to the Russians. And some of that's based on facts that have been established. Some of it's based on conjecture, and then there's hearsay. There's lots of stuff floating around out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what we need to get is the facts. And he could solve a lot of this by opening the books of the Trump Organization and saying, well, this is who we get our money from. Here it is. If this was a public company, this wouldn't even be an issue. All this information would be in the 10-K that they filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. But it's not a public company, so we have a lot of secrecy here. And the bottom line is that I don't think the secrecy in your personal financial dealings is consistent with being president of the United States.
Hmm. Lee, thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Gail in Fish Creek is next. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I have a question for your guest about the firing of Attorney General Preet Bharara. And what I've been reading in different articles in the news about what was under investigation in New York in relation to Mr. Trump and his dealings with money and possible, I don't know, laundering or something I read in one of the articles. I'm wondering what your guest has any insight into if that is a trail that he's starting to leave like a snail.
Well, they certainly need to find out what was going on there. He did make some phone calls to the United States Attorney in New York, Mr. Bharara, and a number of those calls just to so-called shoot the breeze, and then he made another call, and the United States Attorney refused to return the call and then got fired. So we need to find out more about what's going on there and any pressure that President Trump put on other government officials or tried to put on other government officials with respect to Russia. Thus far, what we know about that firing is not as much of a smoking gun as the Comey firing, because first, United States attorneys often are fired at the beginning of an administration. The president replaces the attorney, United States attorneys, with his own U.S. attorneys. President Clinton did that, and there's a lot of that under President Bush. You certainly shouldn't be firing a United States attorney for the wrong reason. We had a controversy over that under President Bush, but generally, the U.S. attorneys are replaced at the beginning of an administration. That's not true of an FBI director who has a 10-year term. And really, while the president can remove him, it's highly unusual for the president to remove an FBI director. We've never had one removed without cause, and there really doesn't appear to be much cause for firing Comey. And then the other thing is that President Trump was able to put pressure on Comey, did actually talk to Comey about the Flynn investigation, at least according to Comey's testimony in his written memorandum, which appears to build a case for obstruction of justice. The conversations with the United States Attorney in New York never got that far, in part because the U.S. Attorney refused to return the president's phone call.
You've mentioned several times that we just don't know where the money is coming from to help fund his business empire here. Why do you think the president hasn't just said, which would clear so much of this up, just, you know, here are the records, here are my tax returns. I know people have been asking for them for a long period of time. I want to clear up any confusion there may be. I want to be transparent.
Well, I don't know. I mean, one theory is he's just plain stubborn and refuses to do it because he doesn't feel like doing it, doesn't think he has to.
Mm-hmm.
He's digging his heels in. If he's doing that, he's taking a sort of an ideological position at an awfully high cost to his administration. The other explanation is there's something in there he wants to hide, and we just don't know what it is.
Hmm. Gail, thanks very much for your call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think, in my opinion, Trump never wanted to be president. This is just, he actually ended up being elected, and he went, wow, man, is this a good business thing for us? We're going to make a ton of money. He's not into it to be a president. He knows that if he gets 4 years in, this is going to make him so much money. That's all he's in it for.
Professor Painter.
Well, we don't know. We're going to see where this all pans out, but he's certainly running up some private legal expenses with this, and I don't think it's going to be pleasant for him. If he goes into the presidency just trying to make a lot of money, he's not going to enjoy himself in that job. I think he'd be much better off at a job where the focus is just about making a lot of money. If he's worth what he says he's worth, he's been pretty good at making a lot of money for himself. I mean, his investors haven't done so well. But I don't think that's going to be a pleasant experience for him. So if that were indeed the case, he might or might not want to finish the whole 4 years.
Hmm. And what's all of this doing to our country? What's it doing to the Republicans and Democrats being able to work together on issues like health care, et cetera? Are we going to be locked in this investigation, dominating the news, dominating our thoughts for a long period of time, Professor Painter? What does it do to our democracy?
Well, it certainly doesn't help. I mean, I wouldn't want to blame gridlock between Democrats and Republicans on Donald Trump. We certainly had a lot of it before. I think both of the parties have increasingly been dominated by the sort of extreme elements. Particularly, we've had that problem in the Republican Party, the extremist elements, trying to put pressure. You know, every time you make any type of confession on anything, whether it's a health bill or gun law or something, the far right people would start jumping up and down and making a lot of noise and threatening to run somebody against you in a primary. So it's a sort of extremist elements in both parties that have really wreaked a lot of havoc. They're obsessed with a certain ideology, with really a dislike of anybody who disagrees with them, and then they go out and raise a lot of money and try and intimidate the politicians. And then the politicians end up adopting a lot of the rhetoric and the ideology of these extremist political groups. So that we've had this before Donald Trump. I don't want to blame all the partisanship in Washington on President Trump. But, yeah, it certainly hasn't helped it.
Professor Richard Painter is our guest this hour. We're talking about the suits that have been filed, suing the president for violation of the Emoluments Clause. There are several of them now, one introduced, and Professor Painter was involved in that one in January. And then we've had the attorneys general earlier this week from Maryland and D.C. issuing a suit. And then yesterday we had close to 200 Democrats filing a suit as well. How important are these? Will they be heard by federal district judges? And what does it do to the country to have all of this going on at the same time? This has not been an easy week. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Bill, we thank you for your call. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We always like to read your comments there. And you can go to Twitter as well, at @KDunnShow. Next caller is John in Milwaukee. Hello, John.
Yeah, hello. Just a few points here. The show business personalities and the so-called comedians and the so-called free press are, you know, ganging up on the president. And point one. Point two is J. Edgar Hoover was one head of the FBI that should have been fired in the 1930s instead of living to preside over the coup d'etat, the murder of the president.
All right, and let's, John, if you have something that's, you know, pertinent, then we'll listen to you. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
I remember back in the early 2000s when George W. was our president, that there was a telecommunications worker who basically blew the whistle on the government, especially the NSA, and said he was instructed to set up routing of basically all digital and, I guess you call it, text messaging or emails, and also all cell phone calls were being routed through the NSA at that time. And I believe it was the day after this man was fired that George Bush announced to the country that, yes, we are listening in on basically everything you do with a cell phone, but don't worry, we're not going to be looking at any American citizens' information. And couldn't, like, all these questions we've been asking so far this hour, a lot of it was through Donald Trump's cell phone. And since the laws are different about wiretapping a cell phone as opposed to wiretapping a landline, and it's already been admitted by our government that the NSA basically has been eavesdropping on all of us using cell phones since 99% of people use cell phones, isn't all this questionable material, like Donald Trump calling the Manhattan Attorney General and shooting the breeze, I mean, that sounds so ridiculous on its face. And then he called him back again, and the Attorney General thought, well, better not ring him back. Isn't that all that information stored right now at the NSA, and could that be subpoenaed by any of these investigations?
I don't think that's accurate, that all the cell phone calls are being monitored. I think there are some that may have been monitored involving people making contacts with terrorist organizations. So I don't know. That was, of course, 10 years ago. So I don't know what the process, what the practice is right now and has been over the 8 years of the Obama administration going into the Trump administration. But I don't think it would be accurate to say that all of our own personal cell phone calls are on storage somewhere in the United States government. I think that's highly unlikely to be the case. So. And that's not what we want. We don't want the government listening in on private citizens' phone calls. Now, if you want to go and contact ISIS or somebody like that, or call a Russian spy, well, you might very well find the United States government listening in on your cell phone call. But that's a very small percentage of the phone calls out there.
Professor Painter, when will we know? What's the status of the January lawsuit? When will we know if this Attorney General lawsuit and the Democrats lawsuit are going to move forward?
Well, I think the Justice Department has responded to the January lawsuit. We're going to find out what the judge wants to do with that. That one's the furthest along, the Crew lawsuit. The other two were just filed, so the Justice Department will respond to those within about 2 or 3 months, and then maybe 2 months, and then we'll see what the judges in those respective cases do with those.
And are there substantial differences among the lawsuits? Tell me more about the Crew lawsuit.
Well, they're all, those three are basically the same in terms of their allegations. I mean, there are some variances. The state lawsuit emphasizes the domestic abandonment clause a bit more. I mean, there's some differences, but they all focus on the same core problem. Each of the different sets of plaintiffs has different standing arguments, and that's important for getting into federal court to have a good argument as to why you ought to be the one in court presenting the case as opposed to somebody else. And Crew is a government ethics reform organization that's had to devote substantial energy to dealing with the emoluments problem since this president took office, and that's the crux of our standing argument. The states, of course, have different arguments, as do the members of Congress. The member of the emoluments clause
specifically says that you can not receive these emoluments without the consent of the members of Congress. So the members of Congress, I think, have a pretty good case to go in there and say, hey, he never came to us for consent. He should be told to cut it out or come to Congress for consent the way the Constitution tells him to.
Jennifer Rubin's article in the Washington Post is what got us thinking about this. We've thought about it before now, but this is a fairly striking headline in the June 13th paper. The Attorney General's suit against Trump may be the most dangerous yet. Would you characterize it as such?
Well, I think it has a substantial weight here. The Attorney General of the state are saying the president's not complying with the Constitution. I mean, I think a court's going to take that seriously.
What's amazing to me is that I don't think anybody, you know, a couple months ago, 3-4 months ago, if you said the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, people would say, what in the world is that?
Well, we haven't had a lot of violations, one. And two, it is a term that we don't use a lot today. It comes from a Latin root, emolumentum, meaning profit or benefit. So the language appears to be archaic, but it's a pretty basic concept. As someone who is a official of the United States government should be taking profits from foreign governments. If we drafted in the 1970s the Constitution or something when I was growing up, we might have called it the Payola Clause of the Constitution. But it's a pretty basic concept. The reason we haven't heard a lot about it is we haven't had a lot of government officials in the United States who want to go make a bunch of money dealing with foreign governments.
It is, and we can't exactly figure out what's inside the president's mind, but if it's true that he has so much money, it is, you know, being president is a pretty big job to work at making money from foreign governments while you're trying to run the United States government. It seems like too many jobs at the same time.
I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, if you want to make money off of foreign governments, you do that. If you want to be president of the United States, you do that. I think it's one or the other.
You were also, I want to go back to this issue for just a moment. You were talking, and something I read here, you were quoted as saying there are lots of opportunities for the president to pick favorites among states, a possibility that other states, perhaps California and Washington, with active Democratic attorneys generals could sue as well, claiming competition, talking about competition and pleas for valuable concessions that adversely affect their own public venues. Elaborate, please.
Well, I don't know what each attorney general is going to make their own decision as to which suits they want to bring. But, you know, the point the founders had with respect to the domestic emoluments clause is the president should be getting a lot of money from one of the states, because otherwise the other states are likely to be at a disadvantage if the president were somehow beholden to one of the states because he's getting a lot of money from that state government. Now, obviously, a president may be biased toward the state he comes from, and he may own businesses in a particular state, and that's enough of a bias. The founders did not prohibit that, but where they drew the line is money coming to the president from the state government or other profits or benefits from the state government.
And when you served in the George W. Bush administration, Chief White House Ethics Lawyer, did you have to deal with anything like this?
Emoluments Clause, generally, no. It came up every now and then, but it was small stuff, like somebody's going to go give a lecture to a German university, and that's a state university, and they were going to get a $1,000 honorarium or something. And, you know, we check on that, and the Office of Legal Counsel said, nope, you can't do that. He can't take the honorarium from a state university, even if it's just $1,000. But it was small stuff, but I saw how strictly it was enforced, the Emoluments Clause. And I thought, you know, is this just some weird arcane provision in the Constitution, or does it have a real meaning? And you look at it, and it has a real meaning and a real purpose. And we were careful to avoid problems. And you know, we had our issues in the Bush administration, everybody knows about. But, you know, I got to say, this notion that the press is picking on Donald Trump, gee, the 8 years of the Bush administration, it was just nonstop, the president getting ripped into by the press. President Obama went through the same thing. And yet both President Bush and President Obama were mature enough not to go running around talking about the media all the time. And we've never had a president talk about the media in such an offensive way. You know, there would be one or two comments made about one particular media source, but But this notion I'm getting beat up on, it's a lot of nonsense.
Thank you, Professor Painter. We're out of time. You sure know the Monuments Clause now, and we thank you very much for being with us. It was an interesting hour. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Professor Richard Painter, he's a professor of law, corporate law at the University of Minnesota. He is a Republican, served as the chief White House ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing the hour, Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production.